Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Oh my goodness, how are you? I'm exhausted, of course.
It's so funny because I didn't realize that you had these like all-nighters when you go to Vegas.
I swear to God, I still think I'm 22. I'm not.
I love it. I think it's awesome. I support it wholeheartedly. And you had fun.
Super fun.
That's so cool.
I'm comped pretty much for everything while I'm there. And I just play, and then all my food and all that stuff. And I love to play cards.
Oh,
I'm very competitive. I love to play blackjack.
Wow.
I could do it for hours and hours. I was just going to say,
is it the type of thing like you look at the clock, you're like, oh my God, I didn't realize what time it is?
Totally.
Yeah.
Chris will say, oh, it's like 4:30. I think it's time to go to bed.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's crazy. And then I'll play other games too. I like to play roulette and all that, but that's usually when I'm winning. So then I just take some, you know,
a pile
of money and go off and do other things.
You know what's so funny? I'm not a gambler. Like, I mean, I understand. I can see the obsession and the fun, and I don't know. It never gravitated
toward
it.
You're a quandary, actually, because I know that you love adrenaline stuff.
Yes,
right? You totally love that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you don't. A lot of the adrenaline things that you could do, you don't do.
Isn't that funny?
It is funny.
Certain things. Yeah, maybe I know deep down it's like, uh-oh, that's bad news for me. But once I start.
You'd be in trouble.
Yeah, exactly.
I could see one of your kids being a gambler.
We know which one, too. Absolutely. For sure.
Well, for me, it's always mixed because my father actually was a proclaimed compulsive gambler.
Oh, he was?
Oh, yeah. So when we were actually growing up, it was kind of interesting whether we would have a house the next day or not. I mean,
he would.
Yeah, we were treated like we were Frank Sinatra when we would go to Vegas. Like, it was Mr. Mandel, the walks to the table, the best shows, the front, backstage passes then when you could go do that. It was pretty remarkable. So I had a little taste for it from very early on.
That makes sense.
I'd go to the track with him or stuff. But when I was 5 years old, you see lots of pictures of me at these great shows with my head down on my plate asleep. It's like, I'll change that. Maybe that was it. It was my embarrassing moments of falling asleep in Vegas. So that doesn't happen anymore.
I want to see pictures of you when you were little. I bet you were so adorable.
Oh,
by the way.
Yeah. You're so cute. Well, my big dimples.
Oh, you have to bring him in. Pictures.
Okay. And you, my dear, you had a relaxing
weekend. I did. I had a nice dinner party. It's so LA to like have a little dinner party at a friend's house. It was great. No adults, some couples, and it was just great.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had adult conversation, no screaming. The only thing that was there was a dog, which was heaven for me, and it was great. Yeah.
Speaking of dogs, we had a fantastic guest on last week, Dr. Liz Fernandez, who is actually my kitty cat holistic vet who comes to the house to do acupuncture. She's just delightful, very spiritual. I know her because she's been working with my cat. By the way, Prowler is back up and running to 100%.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
That's great.
Yes.
So now you're on the prednisone and you're keeping it on
for 2 weeks, and then we drop back down a little bit, but we're not going to try to taper it off too much.
Okay.
So
great.
So there you go. Yeah, she was great.
Awesome. Yes. And her book, I'm blanking on the name of The Sacred Gifts. What was the name of her book? Okay.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So if you missed that show, that was really great. If you have a pet who has some illness or looking for alternative treatments, she was really wonderful and super knowledgeable.
And the process of having to grieve for a pet, you have to put them down.
I mean,
that's a really, really hard thing for people. So it was nice. She
had
very nice softness
comforting
to her.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Dun, dun, dun. Drum roll. Okay, today we have Richard Schneider Jr. Richard received his PhD in sociology from Harvard in the early 1980s. He taught sociology and anthropology as an
Internet scholar.
Okay, thank you. For the University of Maryland's European Division for the next 5 years. He then returned to Boston to become the director of research for a Boston-based consulting firm, the Center for Strategy Research, where he remained through most of the 90s. He founded the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review in 1994 and has remained its editor and de facto publisher ever since. Welcome, Richard.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Sorry for bumbling on that phrase. That what is it again?
I think it's itinerant.
Itinerant.
What is an itinerant scholar, please?
Well, we used to call ourselves gypsy scholars, I think maybe the word gypsy is no longer politically correct. But back in those days, which was in the 1980s, gypsy just meant kind of wandering. And so we were scholars in the sense of, you know, teachers, college profs, but we were not fixed at any one location. We worked for the University of Maryland, which had this program in Europe and Asia, actually, wherever the U.S. had a military presence, basically. So I wasn't in the military myself, but I was mostly teaching service people and their dependents. And so I got to live in Europe for 5 years. It was really cool.
That's so cool.
Very fun.
And you taught.
Yeah, mostly Germany, but also a little bit in Portugal, Spain, and Greece.
So I'm obsessed with sociology. That was my major at the University of Florida. I love that you taught it. I mean, I remember being in class and people would be like, oh, yeah, I have to take this like macroeconomics. And I'd be like, oh, I'm learning about men and masculinities. Like, it was so interesting and fascinating. I loved it. Did you like teaching it, or do you still like teaching it?
I don't actually teach anymore. I loved teaching, and I miss it. I would love to go back at some point, but I don't know. I tell you, this magazine is a harsh mistress. There are so many things that I would like to do, but it's a full-time job. It really is.
So,
it's only bi-monthly, so fortunately, I only have to produce a magazine once every 2 months, but that's kind of a lot.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
That's enough. Yeah.
Now, what inspired you to start that endeavor?
Yeah, it was actually like the early 90s, and I had been just working on a newsletter for a group, an alumni organization called the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus, and I was sort of expanding the newsletter and thinking, you know, maybe I would put out like an annual supplement, because there was just so much to talk about. And we had these great speakers, and they would come and give these great talks, and they would just kind of go down the memory hole. So I was thinking about doing that. And then it was a crazy time. I don't know if you remember. It was 25 years ago, which, of course, that's why we're doing this, because we're having our 25th anniversary. And it was a very tumultuous time in the LGBT movement. And so sort of on the one hand, you know, I had this one foot in publishing, and I was doing this newsletter, and I was kind of learning how to be an editor. And on the other hand, there was so much going on in the world, and especially in the LGBT world, that seemed interesting and worth talking about. And at the same time, it didn't seem like there was any forum that was doing that, that was providing a forum for that kind of discussion. There had been a magazine called Christopher Street, which was kind of dying at that point, and then there were a few attempts. I think there was something called Out Week that came and went, and then there was something called Outlook, and then there's Out Magazine itself, and there were a few others, all in the early 90s. It's really amazing. There was this kind of explosion of magazines, but most of them were kind of slick lifestyle magazines. So the magazine that I founded is much more sort of like, intellectual. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a literary magazine, or a serious magazine, whatever word you prefer. As opposed to sort of travel and lifestyle oriented. And so that's kind of the niche that we have carved out. But I just felt that at that time there was really a need for such a magazine, and there really was nobody else doing it. Mm-hmm. And I had this background in publishing and editing, so I figured, I'm the guy, I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of how it got started. And then I had this organization called the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Caucus, which was, as I say, an alumni group. So at first the magazine was called, in fact, the Harvard Gay and Lesbian Review, because it came out of this organization. And that's kind of a good name. I mean, having an affiliation with Harvard is always nice.
Sure.
So that kind of helped financially and in terms of getting some readers and subscribers, because we had kind of a captive audience in this organization. And that was how we were able to get things going from a sort of financial standpoint.
So I imagine that some of those issues during that time, I mean, AIDS was huge, right? Because 1994, it was still really big, correct?
It was. Yeah. That was like almost like the worst year.
Mm-hmm.
People think of the epidemic in the 80s was terrible, and it kept getting worse and worse. And the antiretrovirals, the drugs, the protease inhibitors, didn't come along until 1996.
Oh, wow.
So people don't think of the 90s as being, in many ways, the first half of the 90s, certainly the worst in terms of sheer numbers of people who were dying and getting sick. And so that was certainly a big issue in the early years for us, absolutely.
When did Magic Johnson get
diagnosed? I think it was 1990, right?
Was it somewhere in there?
Is that right? That sounds about right, yeah. And then, I mean, there was like Rock Hudson was right around that time. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot, it was kind of a high profile thing.
Yeah.
There was definitely a lot of talk. There was no thought about these drugs, life-saving, just amazing. They came along, 1996, 97 was the first I remember hearing about them was at a conference in Key West in January of 1997, and it was called Literature in the Age of AIDS.
Mm.
And of course, because it was about AIDS, everybody was talking about this. And I just had no inkling that these were even in the cards. And then suddenly, bam, these really effective drugs come along and changed everything.
It's so funny because I'm like a product of the 80s, and I remember, I mean, being completely and utterly terrified. They like grilled it into us. You know, I remember it was 1989. I was in fifth grade, and they would show like, you know, documentaries and things about AIDS. And at that time, people did this thing called Blood Brothers, where you like, you know, cut your wrist and then you would mix blood with somebody to show you were blood. And they're like, you cannot do that. Like, it was very, so it's like,
don't do that.
Yeah. Well, it was just really,
it was probably never a good idea
never,
to do that.
Exactly. But I just remember that.
For all like, kinds of reasons.
Yeah. I mean, but it was so terrifying. And now to think that, yeah, that it's not a death sentence anymore is just, it's just amazing
no,
to me.
No, it's not at all.
Yeah.
It's been amazing. It actually has. And in fact, I see, so we are in our 25th anniversary, and the Stonewall riots occurred in 1969, and that's usually taken to be the beginning of the modern gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender movement. So we're sort of like right at the halfway point. Like being founded in 1993, 94, 25 years ago, is kind of like the halfway point in between the Stonewall riots in 1969 and today. And it's an interesting sort of arc, if you look at it, because we were kind of at a low point. Things were really bad. As I was saying, it seemed like we were in a crisis maybe in the early 90s. Clinton had just become president in 1993, and he was immediately hit with the whole gays in the military thing.
Yes.
And that didn't come out very well.
Yeah.
You know, the don't ask, don't tell solution, or supposed to be a compromise that was going to be better, but it really turned out not to be any better. And so that was going on. There was a big march on Washington in 1993, which was like the largest gay march of them all.
Mm.
I think there were like a million people to protest kind of, you know, the setbacks that we were experiencing at that time. There had been a Supreme Court, I should say the Hawaii Supreme Court, had actually legalized gay marriage in 1993, but then it was very quickly reversed by a constitutional amendment of the state legislature. And so that's what gave rise to all of those terrible referendums all through the 90s and the early aught decade that were banning same-sex marriage using constitutional amendments, like state after state, that was happening, so that the elections in 1996 and 2000 and 2004, so that started right around that time. So a whole lot of stuff was going on right at that period.
So was
and things have gotten so much better. I guess that's where I was going, that things like certainly the HIV AIDS epidemic has really turned around dramatically, and a lot of things, you know, notwithstanding the present political situation, which isn't great, and of course everybody's a little scared about what's going to happen, and you know, are we going to experience just like real setbacks or reversals of gains that we've made? But unbalanced, things have certainly moved fairly well, almost unexpectedly well, for the last 25 years.
Well, so I was going to ask, so was the original kind of goal and mission of the magazine was to just bring some more awareness and acceptance around LGBT community, or?
Yes, absolutely. Certainly that was one. It wasn't, I mean, we weren't ever all that political, and there are other magazines that that are more political. Coming out of L.A., as you do, you may be aware of The Advocate, which is a very old magazine, still exists. And that one, I always tried to sort of stay away from their turf, because they have always been a really good magazine that I have respected. And they were the political arm of the, or the political voice in many ways, or forum for the LGBT movement. And they, I think they're monthly now, but for a while I think they were biweekly. They were much more frequent, and they covered news and opinion and commentary and politics and all that stuff. So we have always been more cultural. So we do a large number of book reviews. We do essays, thought pieces, history, biography. Our tagline is a bi-monthly journal of history, culture, and politics. So we get politics in there, mm-hmm. but we also do the history and culture. So certainly one goal is LGBT rights, and we've certainly followed, you know, major developments, Supreme Court decisions, all, you know, referendums and all that stuff. We've also done a lot in the area of history, mm-hmm. biography. A lot of what we do is, it seems like a lot of what we do is going back into the past and finding all the ways in which LGBT culture and individuals and accomplishments have been underreported, let's mm-hmm. say, mm-hmm. or underrepresented, and in some cases suppressed. So there's like a whole sort of secret history that many people have uncovered, going all the way back into ancient times, certainly, but I guess I'm talking more about, let's say, the last 100 years or so. And so I think a lot of what we've done is to go back and, you know, find these people and heroes from the past, and people who were gay but closeted, or who smuggled gay subtexts into their books or into their works or whatnot. Like right now, and I should mention, every issue has a theme. So like right now I'm working on an issue that has a music theme. And so, well, like, for example, there's an article about Leonard Bernstein, who turns 100 this year, and he composed West Side Story and was, and a number of other things. And so, like, there's a whole article about kind of the gay subtext of West Side Story. Now, that's something that you didn't hear about, and I didn't know about when it first came out. But I think he makes a convincing argument that, you know, there's a lot of gay stuff going on, and even though it's clearly a heterosexual love story, but Bernstein, and, well, that's a fascinating story, actually, West Side Story, because it was four gay men, basically, who put it together, all four of them. Jerome Robbins and Arthur Lawrence and Stephen Sondheim and Leonard Bernstein. Wow, I did all four.
Good job.
All four of them were gay men, and they wow. created this thing.
Wow.
Which was very meaningful for me, because I'm of an age, I was born in the 1950s, so for me it was like a big deal. Like, I can remember listening to West Side Story when no one was home, and prancing around the house, like, you know, pretending that I was in the Broadway show, because I don't know why gay teenage boys somehow figure out that they're supposed to like Broadway musicals. I don't know how we all know that, but we all figure it out on our own.
Love it. I think it would be really helpful for us and our listeners to talk about maybe ways in which we can help people overcome homophobia, things to consider, why that exists anyway. I know there's a lot of religious doctrine that says anti-gay, 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 and it's really hard to grow up in that kind of culture and not have some sort of negative feelings, I think.
Yeah.
So maybe we could dive into that a little bit.
Wow, yeah. I mean, it's a huge topic. We've done whole issues that are just on, you know, the issue of homophobia, and like, where does homophobia come from? I mean, it's kind of like, where does racism come from? Although probably it has different sources, or where does any kind of xenophobia come from, or fear of others? So, like, maybe at the very basic level, there is just something in our DNA, I mean, maybe quite literally they're finding something in our DNA that leads us to prefer people like us. And that's something that has to be overcome very clearly, because we live in a global world now where everybody is in contact with everybody else. And maybe we've done pretty well in some ways, the fact that we get along at all and we can live in a multiracial and multi-everything society with gay people achieving more acceptance these days. But maybe there's like almost a substrate of xenophobia that's just there. But specifically, homophobia, yes, religion is certainly a big part of it. You know the old song from South Pacific, you have to be taught to hate. Mm. You know, it has to be, hatred is something that has to be cultivated. And certainly most homophobia is something that is just learned. It's something that you can come from a fairly liberal urban upbringing, as I did in the New York metropolitan area, and not really get a big dose of homophobia, or you can be raised in, let's say, the rural South,
yeah,
or many other parts of the, I don't know, parts of the Midwest, where it's drilled into you, and you know, you just learn, and it's part of your Sunday sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
you know,
I distinctly
so
remember.
I think that is probably the biggest one, and certainly dealing with the homophobia that's built into religion, and specifically the evangelical movement, which has been very strong certainly since the 1970s, that has been the major barrier to gay rights, you know, in every step of the way, whether you're talking same-sex marriage or service in the military or getting a basic law to protect LGBT people at the workplace. The major obstacle has always been the religious right. That's what we encounter every step. So certainly religion is a big one. Then there's also just, I don't know, I think it's part of most cultures to have what's often called the norm of pronatalism, right? Children are good. Mm-hmm. You want to have kids. Most cultures put pressure on teenagers to get married, or people in their 20s. Mm-hmm. Get married, procreate, have kids, because we want grandchildren.
Right.
And so it's really strong in, I don't know, China, for example,
mm-hmm.
and many Asian societies. But it's certainly also very strong in our society,
yeah,
and most European, sure, ones as well. So I've always thought that one of the major sources of homophobia is this this sense that you want your kids to grow up, get married, and make babies, and give you grandchildren. And if you are of that generation that's, you know, waiting for your heirs to show up.
Right.
So I think that's a big part of it also. And again, it's cultural. And, you know, mm-hmm. some societies, I think it's a bigger deal. I don't know, India, for example, I'm talking about two very large societies, China and India, both have that, I think. And it's where there's a huge emphasis on the family.
Yes.
And there's almost a feeling of obligation, mm-hmm. that, you know, if you're a young man or a young woman coming of age, you are really expected to get married and do your family duty, which is to have kids.
Mm.
And overcoming that norm or that standard is something that has been very tough also. So it seems like there's quite a few different sources for homophobia, I would say. And most of them are cultural, and most of them can be overcome. And I think we've done, mm-hmm. a reasonable job in educating people over the last 25 years, let's say. I think we've made, yeah, progress. But as you say, it's sure still out there.
I can distinctly remember growing up and my dad saying to me, he says, I can tolerate anything in you except if you tell me that you're gay. And I just remember,
really?
Hearing that and saying, wow.
Wow.
Whoa. Now, this is a man, by the way, who was a Holocaust survivor, mm-hmm. who was persecuted for being Jewish. So
right.
it was always such a, like, what powerful homophobia he had. And when I went to graduate school, it was fascinating because they asked me, what is the population you don't think you could work with? And mm-hmm. it was just like, well, I was taught I'm not allowed to, you know, invite gays yeah. into my life. And I met so many gay friends in my first year of graduate school because it wasn't an abundance in our school at all. And sure. I was like,
did you ask your father? Like, what would you say? Like, in his case, like, why was he so homophobic, would you say?
I don't know. I don't know if he was sodomized or something when he was, you know, in the war. You know, he didn't talk about those kinds of things, but
sure.
it's very possible that...
It's interesting you mention that because I had a Jewish partner for 8 years, and they were great. They were wonderful liberal Jews from the East Coast. Actually, they were from Providence, Rhode Island. And, you know, they were totally wonderful people, and they had totally accepted their son. Mm-hmm. But it was a little bit of a struggle at first. And the one thing, when it really came, push come to shove, they didn't mind, they didn't dislike gay people intrinsically. They wanted grandchildren.
Right.
And they just said that,
they were disappointed.
Like, the one yeah. thing that was so disappointing, they said that having children for them was the biggest reward mm-hmm. of their lives and the greatest joy. And it wasn't even selfish, necessarily. It wasn't even just like, we want grandchildren.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it wasn't like they were just trying to impose that because they had another son who did give them grandchildren. But they just felt that my partner's name was Ben. They just felt that Ben was being deprived of
yeah.
Mm-hmm. of some really of just a really important part of life, and they felt really, really bad about that. And Ben just said, "Don't worry about it. You know, it's like, I'm okay. Like, I don't have, not everybody has to have children, right?"
This is so funny because as you were talking, I'm Jewish, and I'm thinking, "Oh my God!" I remember there was a point I was about 28, and I said, I was thinking, maybe I do have two kids now, but there was a point where I was like, I don't know, you know, maybe I don't want kids. Maybe my husband and I will just travel and do all this stuff. And I told my mother.
Oh gosh.
And it did not go over well. But so I know exactly yeah. what you're saying. It's this, I don't know. And I think it is like this idea of like, oh no, that's not what you do. Like, you don't travel around, like, you have grandkids. I mean, it was just so like foreign, and you know, she was just shocked. But yeah, so when you were talking, I was completely thinking about that.
There's another yeah. huge contradiction in our society that I don't know if you could speak to this at all, Richard, but I find it fascinating. So there are so many men that are very, very homophobic, but the propensity of girl-on-girl porn mm-hmm. in the industry, of that men enjoy watching, but yeah. somehow that's not disgusting to them,
right.
but their own gender is. Do you find it, have you heard
the
of
hypocrisy
this?
About
yeah, I just find it so fascinating.
It is fascinating. Yeah, that could be like a long answer. Let me think about this one, because I have thought about that, and I think many people, well, first of all, if you take the position of heterosexual men mm-hmm. who are only attracted, let's say they really are sixes on the Kinsey scale, they really are only attracted to women.
Mm-hmm.
So if they look at straight porn, there's a guy.
Right.
There's a penis. They mm-hmm. don't want that. They mm-hmm. don't want to look at that. They don't want to see it. They're, you know, in some sense, they're, even though they have one themselves, which is always interesting, I always find, like, you can't be that turned off by it, like, you know.
Like, you have one,
but yeah,
you like your own, you like playing with that, right?
Yeah, I know. So I think that I kind of get that, actually, from the standpoint of a heterosexual man who really just doesn't at all get turned on, and is mm-hmm. even maybe repelled by the sight of another man mm-hmm. in a sexual act. That would be something that would be quite arousing. I can see that. I sort of get that. From, you know, trying to put myself in that perspective.
Sure.
I don't know if that answered your question, though. About
I don't even know that there is an answer. I just really wanted to put it out there.
Yeah.
It just seems like
yeah.
it was a fascinating.
Yeah.
Human beings are just fascinating to
yeah.
me, you know. What about the coming out process these days? I think that...
Much easier.
Much
than,
easier?
Yeah.
But
I
is
think,
it? I mean, is it? Is
yeah.
it still safe at school with your friends? Is it
I think,
safe?
I think so much depends upon location and where... I mean, I suspect that in a city like Los Angeles, depending upon your culture,
mm-hmm.
maybe I can only speak for Anglo culture, since that's the only one I'm really familiar with, to be honest. But I suspect that in a city like L.A. or New York City, which is basically where I'm from, it's not hard at all. But, you know, there are still pockets, or maybe more than just pockets. There are probably just whole regions where it's still really tough. I don't know if you've heard about this new movie called Love, Simon, which has gotten quite a lot of attention.
Yeah, I want to see it. Yeah, I want to see that, too.
Yeah, it's really, it's a good movie. It's kind of a, well, it's a romantic comedy, so I guess you'd call it a, I guess out there you call that a rom-com, right?
Yes,
right.
And it's about coming out sort of, you know, 2018 style, and it's basically, it's not hard at all. His parents are completely cool about it, you know? And
that's interesting.
It's not the first movie that's done that. In fact, his mother, like, actively tries to help Simon find a boyfriend. So his biggest problem is figuring out, okay, so the basic plot line is that he knows that there's somebody in his class who's gay, because who goes by the name Blue, and he's been texting. He's texting and emailing and communicating with Blue, but he can't figure out who Blue is. So the gag of the movie is that he's got all these friends, and you know that one of his friends is probably going to turn out to be Blue. He and Blue sort of fall in love. I don't know if it's possible to fall in love with somebody that you've never actually met, but you know, if it is, sort of the premise is that you could fall in love with somebody that you're texting with or emailing. And so that's kind of the premise. So then the whole movie is sort of structured around figuring out who Blue is. So that's the biggest problem, you know? It's not like he encounters homophobia. There's one other kid in his class who's transgender, who does take some of the brunt of homophobia. And that's interesting. Like, if you don't mess around with gender, if you're basically sort of like a dude, you know, and you don't, like, dress strangely or anything, you probably will be accepted nowadays, I think, in most high schools across America.
Sure.
It's when you cross that gender line. That seems to be what freaks people out. Isn't that interesting? What do you make of that? You're both psychologists. Why is it gender seems to freak people out much more than sexual orientation? I don't know, but that seems to be the case. And that's something that they deal with in this movie. So anyway, but coming out is always like it's a big thing, but not as big as it used to be.
And so I can imagine, because I mean, it was so different in the 60s and 70s, and now I feel like I talk to people who are in their 20s, and it's very normal to date women and men. It's just like, you know, that's just kind of what you do. But I think you're right.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, that's
okay. Is that true for women and men, or is it more true for women that they're sort of cool about just being bisexual?
I think it's probably easier still for women. I do.
I remember going to a seminar, and the woman who was teaching it was about gay and lesbian, and I said, so, you know, is there a difference between men and women? She says, yeah, with women, it's usually what's the flavor of the day. I fall in love with the person. Mm-hmm. If it's male, it's male. If it's female, it's female. But there wasn't that sort of separation of I can't fall in love with one or the other, which I thought was really nice. So that she was saying that a lot of women don't actually like to identify themselves in their sexual preference at all. It's just, you know, what happens in their life. I thought that was interesting. Yeah.
Well, I think it's much more I think it's okay for women to be bisexual. And I think with men, it's like, oh, you're not bisexual, you're gay. Like, I think, you know, I've heard that quite a bit. I've had some clients who he identified as a bisexual, and he said he would tell women, okay, I'm bisexual, and they would say, oh, no, you're gay. Like, come on, you know? And, and it's so sad.
I can totally understand that.
Right? It's like, they you know, that's not allowed. You know, you're in denial, so to speak. And so I think there is some backlash with that.
Well, I mean, there is also the fact, or I don't know if it's a fact, but there's research suggesting that male sexuality and female sexuality are somewhat different, and that maybe women really are more fluid. And men, who knows why this would be, but it just seems that perhaps men really are more fixed at a certain point in time, and it's much less likely that a guy is going to switch or change or experiment once that gelling has taken place, whereas women seem to be more flexible.
Uh-huh.
Maybe in general, women are more flexible, but that's a whole different discussion, I suppose.
But I think it could be it is hard to be bisexual in our society because we have a very strong monogamous pressure in our relationship. And so it's hard to identify with, okay, I'm with this man now, but I'm still attracted to women. But if I'm in a monogamous relationship, then I can't really explore that, which may have been part of what polyamory became more popular, for people to just be open and honest about that instead of so fixed.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting trend, and I've had people come to me and say that they want to, that they think we should explore polyamory as a separate sexual orientation, and we haven't so far, because I have to say I don't know that much about it, and nobody has come forth with, like, the sort of killer article about polyamory that I would publish, but it is an interesting trend. And just this whole idea, what you're describing is very, now that's really important, actually, what you just described, because it's a real change that's taken place in the whole LGBT world, and that is this whole idea of not labeling, or being more fluid, or refusing to call yourself gay or lesbian. And that's common for both, I think, boys and girls, because they're so young. At this age, people coming out in their teens. And I think that's very common. So certainly my generation, it's not. You know, you came out, and coming out meant you announced to the world, I am gay, I am lesbian, and that's that. Uh-huh. And so, you know, that's just take it or leave it.
Sure.
And now there's really quite the opposite trend. You don't want to label. There's a great resistance to labeling, and you want it not. I don't know. If keeping your options open, I think, is maybe too cynical, because I think it's more than just keeping options, like as in sexual options, open. I mean, I think there's a genuine resistance to labels, and maybe that's a good thing. I don't know.
Sure.
But it's certainly a change, though, and one that we're sort of dealing with.
Yeah.
Because here we are. Our name is old-fashioned. We, as I said, we came out of a group called the Gay and Lesbian Caucus.
Right.
And so we're stuck with the name the Gay and Lesbian Review, but we recognize that that's very old-fashioned, and it excludes the B's and the T's.
Right.
And so if we could change the name easily, we would, and we've talked about doing something.
Oh, that's
but
interesting.
Certainly, you know, we would like to somehow capture this idea, especially now with the new generation, the younger kids, the younger generation of people who are resistant to labels. We would do something that might
be more inclusive.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Open the doors to more different kinds of sexuality. And I think that's where we are, though, this idea that sexuality is very diverse, and there are just many different forms and expressions, and it changes over time, and why have fixed labels, which I find a very interesting idea. It's just one that's hard for us to grapple with, given our history, given, let's say, the history of the magazine.
That makes sense.
I like diversified sexuality worldwide.
Oh, she's thinking of a name.
I'm already thinking
magazine.
Of a name.
I find this so fascinating, and I loved the series. I don't know if you saw Masters of Sex.
No.
Oh, it was so good. I was either on Netflix or one of the series, and it's it was with it was Masters and Johnson, and it was with it was kind of fictional but based on true stories, and kind of how he learns about sexuality. And I mean, he was a researcher, and he and his assistant kind of he had an affair with his assistant for quote-unquote research purposes, but it's a fascinating take on sexuality in the 1950s, and he published papers on orgasms, which shocked his colleagues, and it wasn't talked about, and, you know, bisexuality, but it's a great series, so, yeah. So.
Wow. Well, of course, that also is the era of Kinsey. Kinsey's work, his book on men or males came out in 1948, and females, I think it was 52 or 3. And so right in that era, there was a whole explosion of interest in sexuality, and kind of the whole idea that this is actually a topic that is worth studying like any other research topic or any other aspect of human psychology. And it turns out, I mean, of course, we'd already been through Freud, who might have placed sex too close to the center of human psychology. But yeah, we've got this next issue that I'm just putting together has an article about the Kinsey Institute, and it's fascinating. It started in the 50s, and it's at, of all places, the University of Indiana.
Oh, wow.
Which one thinks of Indiana as being a conservative place, and it is. And one point it makes, to this day, it's still controversial. And there are still people in the, you know, Indiana and in, you know, across the country that want to shut down this institute,
really?
Which has been there for, you know, 60 years at this point.
Wow.
But because it's about sex, and because we live in basically, in many ways, we live in a prudish country.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. To this day, there are people who want to shut down its funding and take mm-hmm. away its basic mandate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, that's fascinating.
Yeah, that's still out there. I mean, there's still a fight to be fought. I mean, one concern that we have is that, you know, there will come a point at which being gay, lesbian, et cetera, is so commonplace and so widely accepted that maybe there will be no place for a magazine like this, or maybe there won't even be a place for LGBT culture. Like, maybe we'll just be so completely assimilated mm-hmm. and integrated into mainstream society that this so-called LGBT movement mm-hmm. and all the magazines and all the bars and the clubs and the meeting places and all that stuff will eventually just disappear. Impossible.
Is that amazing for you to say that? Like, when you say that, did you ever imagine that in your lifetime, that that would even be a possibility?
No, I have to say, I absolutely did not. I really never thought in my lifetime that there would be same-sex marriage in this country. And again, it's something that just, whoa, I give credit to Evan Wolfson and Mary Bonato and the people that waged that fight
mm-hmm.
Because they did a hell of a job. I never thought it would happen in my lifetime, but but here we are. Well, and, you know, and there have been critics in the LGBT world of that fight, that very fight, because, but same-sex, but, you know, marriage is a very conservative institution, so do we really just want to be like everybody else?
Right.
Do we just want to integrate into society and lose our identity and our sense of difference? And that's, and it's still, the question is out there.
Sure.
Like, okay, so we have same-sex marriage, so, you know, we're moving out to the suburbs, so, you know, slowly but surely, many of the markers of this distinctive culture are going away. Gay bars are closing down, and that's just, you know, a fact. It's probably because of the internet, though, more than anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so there really is a question of, you know, what, you know, here we are at our 25th anniversary. Well, what will the next 25 years be like? I don't know if I'll be here to see that, but I don't even want to do the math. Oh, actually, I could be. Yeah, I might still be around.
But it is a good question. What is your hope for the magazine?
Yeah. For the magazine or for the LGBT movement?
Both.
Or both?
Yeah.
Yeah, both. I would hope that for the LGBT movement, you know what we really need right now is what's called ENDA. It stands for the Employment Non-Discrimination Act.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that it's been on the table since the 1970s, and many states have it. Certainly California does, and Massachusetts, where I am. But many states don't, and we don't have a national ENDA. And I would say the first thing, just to give you kind of a political response, the first thing we need is to get an ENDA. You know, once we have a Democratic president and some majorities in Congress and the Senate, let's, you know, fingers crossed, that might happen, and it should happen. Because it's happened in every other advanced country, really, that you have basic protections.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think what will happen is that this assimilation will continue and the mainstreaming will continue, and there will be the sense that being gay is no longer that remarkable. But my hope is that there will still be enough of a sense of identity, of LGBT identity, that there will be a place for a magazine like the Gay and Lesbian Review.
Mm-hmm.
I often think that our culture, there are many parallels with American Jews, that there is a lot of assimilation, it's tough to maintain an identity, there is a lot of pressure not to have an identity, there's mm-hmm. lots of intermarriage at this point for Jews,
so,
and so you could ask the same question, well, what will happen in that world? And I think it's a problem, it's an issue, it's something that every minority probably faces this, that in a paradoxical way, the very success of the movement tends to undermine the movement
mm-hmm.
or the sense of a movement. Like the movement is necessary and the struggle is necessary because you're an oppressed minority.
Right.
So what happens when you're no longer an oppressed minority?
Totally understand.
Then you begin, you're accepted and you assimilate and everybody welcomes you with open arms and you move out to the suburbs and the bars close and there's, so there is a sense of that that's a concern. That,
sure.
Yeah. My guess is, so my prediction is that it will be sort of parallel to American Judaism in many ways, and that is that it will continue, it will still have an identity, there will still be people, being gay will always be different, and there will still be people who are LGBT, and that will be different because you will have a different lifestyle, and whether you're accepted or not, or whether you live in the suburbs, you're still probably going to have different friends and go to different places and engage in different kinds of activity, and that will still be true even if the political struggle is no longer as intense as it once was. So my prediction is that LGBT culture, sort of as a cultural phenomenon, and identity as perhaps a psychological phenomenon, will continue to exist, but that it will be, just as it is now already, a much less intense or urgent kind of struggle than it once was.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
And if anybody has a submission, if somebody wants to submit an article or an essay or such something, would they send that directly to you, or is it a closed system?
Oh, no, it's not closed at all. In fact, I would certainly encourage, totally encourage people to send proposals and, of course, also subscribe. I mean, I guess the first place to go is our website, which is glreview.org. So it's very easy, just glreview.org.
Oh, great.
And you'll see there's a button there actually, we have a new website, so actually you have to go to the bottom, and there's like a little thing at the bottom that says for submissions. And it's just, I think specifically it's editor@glreview.org.
Okay.
But all you have to do is go to our website and find it there. And we would totally encourage people to do that, not only to submit articles, but also to think about subscribing. You know, but check us out on the website and see what you think about the magazine. And then if you like it, a subscription is not expensive. It's only $23 a year.
Wow.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
So
I was just going to say, we want to wish you such congratulations, and you're such a pioneer in this field, and, you know, I'm just so proud of all you've done, and, you know, we're super happy to have you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, and also, of course, for this opportunity. It's been great talking to you.
Awesome. We've been speaking with Richard Schneider Jr., the editor-in-chief and founder of the Gay and Lesbian Review Worldwide, and you can visit him and his whole thing at the glreview.org. Thank you so very much.
Yes, thank you so
much. Well, you're very welcome, and I really enjoyed it. And
best
of luck.
You don't sound a day over 30.
You do sound young.
You sound really?
So young.
It's the yoga.
You said you were,
I always tell people, because I look younger also, and so I always tell people it's the yoga.
I love
for
it.
Sure.
I'm totally into yoga, and I really believe that. I think it's, you know,
absolutely,
kept me in good shape. Yeah.
We're on board with that.
Well, thank you so much. Congratulations again. Thank you.
Oh, well, thanks a lot.
Sure.
Thank you. Best of luck.
Thank you. And next week we have
Jonathan
Robinson.
More love, less conflict.
Love it.
That'll be great. Be a good another segue into acceptance and love and all that good stuff.
Yeah.
So we have a new name change on Instagram. So it's @2TWOShrinks, SHRINKS. And come visit us there or send us emails. Come visit our website, docandtherapist.com.
All right.
Thank
you
so much.
Have a beautiful week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.